Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Cory Doctorow. Cory is a science fiction author, activist, and journalist. He's the author of many books, most recently Radicalized and Walk Away, Science Fiction for Adults, In Real Life, a graphic novel, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, a book about earning a living in the internet age, and Homeland, a young adult sequel to Little Brother. His next book is Posey the Monster Slayer, a picture book for young readers. Cory's been a friend of Kevin and mine for a really long time, so it is great to have him on the show. Hey, Cory, how's it going?
It's super great. I am not dead of coronavirus.
Yay! You're all alive. And we have social distancing working right now, too.
We do.
Yeah. Yeah, everything. It's weird as a person who works from home to have all these people going, isn't it weird to be working from home?
Yeah, for me, it's like life as usual. I actually like have not really left the house since Sunday, except to drive my daughter to school, and they just closed their school for 2 weeks. Yeah, so
mine too.
I'm not. Oh yeah, they did that for your school as well.
San Francisco as well.
Yeah.
So, and not for 2 weeks, for at least 2 weeks, I think is more accurate to say.
Right. Yeah. You're right. And I think it will be a lot longer than that. So, Cory, you've got four tools to talk about. And the first one is a snap lock knife that you like. Tell us.
Yes, let me play the sound of the snap lock.
That's snappy.
I hear that. Very snappy sound.
Yeah, Cricut is a really great high-end knife maker. They're up there with like Fiskars and other pocket knife manufacturers. And they came out with this design that's kind of a novelty design. It's got this like weird steampunk gear. It's basically impossible to describe in audio. You really have to go look at it. But it's a skeleton knife in the sense that it's a kind of minimal weight knife. It's got lots of holes drilled in it and more of a frame than a case. And it does this thing where this gear mechanism, you pry it apart with your thumb and then you click the knife into place and it locks open. And then you do it again and it locks shut again. It's a one-hand operation. It's got a little clip for your shirt pocket. And I carry it so frequently and use it so often that I've actually had to buy about four of them because I forget and I take them to the airport because it's just automatic now that I've got one clipped into the breast pocket whatever I'm wearing. So it's unbelievably useful. It's got a little lanyard. A little lanyard hook so that it's easy to kind of tie up and keep track of. And it really takes and holds an edge. I got a really nice electric sharpener. I think it was the Wirecutter's top pick for electric sharpener, the Trizor sharpener. And I put a really deadly edge on it and it still got it. And I just, I use it to open boxes and like pry stuff open. I don't treat it with the respect that a great knife is due. And it's holding up very well.
And it has like a belt clip on it as well.
It's got the kind of clip that you get on like a pair of glasses that has a little case, little clip that you clip on, or like a pen's shirt clip. Only right. It's made out of some kind of heavy duty steel that's pretty robust.
Okay.
And so yeah, this little like kind of like you said, that steampunky little mechanism looks like a kind of like a cam. Or something that you push.
That's right.
On a little knurled knob, and it like deploys the blade.
Yeah, it's beyond. It's not just utilitarian. It's actually what I like about it is that it clearly put utility before everything else. And nevertheless, they then went in and said, okay, well, we're going to have these like vents to reduce the weight and so on. We need these three little bolts on the down here to hold the frame together and so on. How can we arrange them to make them as aesthetically pleasing as possible? So it's as decorative as it can be without sacrificing the form, and not any more than that. So it's this perfect balance of both.
Right.
And it's only 2.5 ounces, which is probably why you forget you have it in your pocket.
Yeah, that's the skeleton element. The blade has got some holes drilled out of it, as does the shirt clip. And as I say, it's not a case, it's a frame. And so it does keep the edge away from anything that it could cut, but it's not like a fully encased knife with a big thick frame or a big thick case that would add a lot of weight.
And the opening and closing, is it like a spring action where actually like a switchblade where it's actually moving itself, or this allows you to close it in a safe manner?
So there's a spring loaded element to it, which is that the cam that you have to push aside to open the blade is spring loaded. And so it has some resistance, so it doesn't pop open accidentally in your pocket. Then when you let go of it, it does pop back like that. But it actually opens in this way that's, again, hard to describe. So if you think about how a flick knife or switchblade or just a regular pocket knife opens, the blade is in the same axis as the handle. So it comes up in a kind of arc that follows the handle. So if you're looking at the knife edge on and you open it up, the blade would open towards you. What this does is it opens perpendicular to the frame. It actually opens at a 90 degree angle, swings around until it's in line with it, until it's parallel with it, and then and only then does it lock in place. And then when you unlock it, it flips back down again perpendicular to the axis, the long axis of the frame.
Right. So it's like a hinge almost.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly like a hinge. You must have a mechanical engineering degree. It's yes, it's a much clearer explanation than I just gave. It is a hinge. Yeah.
Right. That's cool.
Yeah, okay, and we'll have a link. I think that there is a nice page on the Cricut page that actually has a video, and then you can see the mechanism in action.
Yeah, you really want to see it doing its thing. It's one of those things that is an absolute delight to use. It really reminds me of the book Don Norman wrote.
The Design of Everyday Things.
No, the sequel. The one where he recanted the design. Oh, Emotional Design. Mm. So, you know, he wrote this book, Design of Everyday Things, that was basically like, hey, engineers, stop trying to make things beautiful. You have to make them work. And, you know, the example was that teapot with the handle on the same side as the spout. So if you tried to pour it out, you would burn your hand. And then, you know, 20 years later, I guess, after, you know, being this dominant force in design philosophy for decades, he published this book called Emotional Design. And its core philosophy was like, everything is always broken because complicated things never work. The only way to make things work is to solve problems that they create when they stop working. And you can't solve problems when you're angry, and beautiful things make you happy. And so beautiful things make you better at solving problems. And since everything is always broken, it works better if you're happy when you're using it.
Huh.
So really remarkable philosophy.
Right.
Yeah.
So the idea is that beauty counts.
Yeah, that beauty is functional because complex systems are non-deterministic and require perspective and finesse and thoughtfulness and calmness, right? Introspection and so on. When the thing doesn't work, you know, the listeners won't know this, but this is our fourth try recording this because we went through several other recording options before we could record this. And when things don't work, you have to figure out how to make them work. And you can't make them work when you're just going like, oh, I hate this, and I hate the person who designed it, and I hate my life. And you know, we've all been there, right? We've all been like putting together a model or like something snap fit and it wouldn't work, or a piece of IKEA furniture, and we're just like, oh, I'm not gonna Fonz this. I'm gonna percussively maintain it. I'm just gonna hit it. And then we hit it and then it never works, right? Whereas like Fonzie had the right approach, right? You have to find like the right spot and just give it the right tap. Not a hard tap, just the right tap. And you can't find that right tap when you're just in a fury. You know, Yosemite Sam never gets anything done.
Yeah. So this design is in that mode of enticing you to give it respect, to enjoy it, and that's one of the reasons why it works so well.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're just like, especially when you think, you know, a knife is a tool, and oftentimes when you have a tool in your hand, it's because something broke. So, you know, not having something like being around something that's broken and then getting your tool out and going, oh, what a nice tool I have, puts you in the right headspace to go like, all right, now let's make this thing work.
I love it. That's great. So Corey, you are a swimmer. You swim like every day, I think. And so,
although
you have a,
you know, they closed my community pool yesterday for the rest of the month at least. So I got an email at like 5 o'clock and I'm like, right, I've had a swim today, but I'm going for another one. And it was, and all of the hardcore people that I see there, like the people that are there every day, we were all in the changing room, like within 15 minutes of them sending out that we're closing the pool tonight, not opening again for 3 weeks or whatever. So yeah, I do. I'm a very ardent swimmer. I've got a really bad back. I've got chronic pain problems, and now I've got arthritis in both hips. And swimming is really important for my physiotherapy. It's basically what allows me to live a normal life and work normally.
Wow. And so you swim laps then?
Yeah, I swim laps, which again, now we're zeroing in on my next tool, because right, swimming laps is unbelievably boring.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And so what do you do to alleviate the boredom?
So I listen to audiobooks on my underwater MP3 player.
Oh, wow. That is so, so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my jam.
Do you find that you're able to actually pay attention enough while you're swimming to the book?
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I get through a couple of books a month, including big challenging works of nonfiction. Like that's how I read Zuboff's Surveillance Capitalism, which frankly is like not a great book, but or at least a book that has some deep problems. But you know, I was able to listen to it carefully enough and digest it enough that I wrote a 35,000 word rebuttal to it that Motherboard's about to publish. So you know, like that's it is attentive listening. I went through the whole Chronicles of Amber this year, or last year rather, the Roger Zelazny books, which I'd never read. You know, they were like the book to read in my social circle when I was about 13, and there are 10 of them. And I read them all in the pool. I'm just getting through Matt Stoller's Goliath, which is his antitrust book. I read the Zephyr Teachout's book about corruption.
A whole ton of them.
Yeah.
So the swimming to you is just something you don't even think about then. You're just all completely automatic and you're just listening.
Yeah. I mean, I do have like a pattern I swim. I do high impact interval training swim where it's a series of sprints with cool downs in between, and it builds from like, you know, single lap sprints to double lap sprints to four lap sprints, and then a cool down. And so I do have to keep track in my head, but it's not a big lift.
Okay.
Cool. That's so cool. And so this player is about $70. Is that right?
Yeah. So I have to say, I gave you this specific player, but this is a Chinese OEM and there's 50 versions of it. And they last, like if you swim every day like me, and I swim in the sea as well, maybe 10 times a year. And I think the salt water is a little harder on it. It lasts for maybe a year, maybe a year and a half. And what I find is that like every year and a half, I buy another identical one, but it's got a different manufacturer's name on it. In the UK, it was called Exeez, E-X-E-Z-E. I forget what the brand name is of the one that I sent you guys. But they're all Diver. Yeah, they all come out of the same factory, I'm sure. Or there's a bunch of factories that have stolen each other's designs. But they're all like, they're all about as reliable. Like none of them are you know, something I would like put in a survival kit for 10 years in the jungle or something, but like you know, so long as our supply chains from the Pacific Rim hold up, they're a pretty good bet.
Well, you're not hoarding them, right?
I do have three or four spare though. And so yeah, the way that they work is there's they have a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack, the last device that I own that has my beloved 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. And You plug a USB cable that's got a microphone on one side and a regular USB-A on the other, and you plug that into your computer and it just mounts as a mass storage device. And then you drag files into it and they play back in their creation order. So you have to drag them in order, or just, you know, hope that if you drag the whole folder in that they all come in order, which usually they do. There've been a couple of gonks where they didn't come in order because the one file finished faster than the other, cause it's doing multi-threaded file transfer and it's moderately fast. It charges that way as well. And what I find is that if I recharge it every time I change over a book, which would be like, you know, twice a month, once every 3 weeks, if I fully charge it, then I never run out of battery. So I charge it once every 3 weeks or so, and I swim for about an hour a day, 6 to 7 days a week.
And is loading it like from Audible a problem or not?
So we're getting into my next pick as well. Yeah, Audible has DRM. Audible does not give you MP3s. And in fact, Audible will not allow artists or rights holders to opt out of their DRM. So everything else Amazon sells, you don't have to choose their DRM. Like, you can put an MP3 up instead of a DRM'd audio file if you're in the Amazon Music Store. You can have your Kindle book sold without DRM. And the difference is that Amazon doesn't dominate those sectors, but 90% of the audiobook market is controlled by Amazon through Audible. Right. And so Amazon says, when it comes to audiobooks, you as the rights holder have to allow them to lock every single customer that you entice to buy a book to their platform. And, you know, because the way that copyright law works, Section 12.1 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act makes it a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine to make a tool to unwrap those books so that they can be played on a rival device. And that applies even if you are the rights holder. So I, as the copyright proprietor of an audiobook, so I write the novel, then I pay to record the audiobook. I'm just finalizing the audiobook session for Attack Surface, which is the Third Little Brother book that Tor is publishing in October, but I retain the audio rights, and I'm going into a studio next week with Amber Benson from Buffy the Vampire Slayer to record that audiobook. So I own the book. I wrote the book. I paid for the recording. It is my copyright. And Amazon will not let me choose not to lock it to their platform. And if I sell it through their platform and I give you a tool to unlock my copyrighted work, I commit a copyright violation that's a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence. And wow. So nothing that Audible makes will play on just a vanilla MP3 player, which includes these little Chinese crap gadget audio, like waterproof MP3 players. And so, yeah, you can't use Audible for it. You can use everything else, but not Audible.
Unless you have a illegal tool.
Yeah, unless you have one of these, that, you know, there are lots of rippers for them. And of course, that's the great irony is, like, their claim is that, you know, the reason they do this is to protect copyright, and like pirates can't unravel their wrappers. And of course, like, it is a single Google search. Right. To figure out how to remove the DRM from one of their audiobooks. And like, if you go to a site like Audiobook Bay, you can get all of Audible's audiobooks for free. And you know, obviously it doesn't work. So, you know, this argument that what they're doing is protecting artists, you know, first of all, if they're really protecting artists, then you would think that the artist would get to choose whether or not mm-hmm. they want to be protected.
Right.
You know, I have this in that book I wrote, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free. I posit Doctorow's first law, which is, if a company puts a lock on something that belongs to you and won't let you take it off again, they didn't put that lock on it for your benefit. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty clear that's not for your benefit. But, you know, also, like, it's clearly not stopping pirates. Pirates just pirate. And right. So it's all it's doing is, it's basically creating a new tort or a new crime, right? Which is like felony contempt of business model, right? Like, it becomes a felony not to arrange your affairs in ways that make Jeff Bezos' shareholders happy, even when doing so involves harming your own interests.
Right.
Wow. You Google, you can find a tool to get your Audible book if you want to put it onto these devices. Otherwise, you can just use other sources for your
books. Yeah, and podcasts work great too. Podcasts are all MP3s. So, right. Yeah, you just download the MP3 from the podcast.
Right.
That's great. So, Corey, we have a few more minutes left. I just wanted you to tell us about the battery pack you use for your phone.
Yeah. Well, let me put a pin in that one by saying my other choice was Libro.fm, which is an independent audiobook platform that sells every single audiobook in MP3 form, with the exception of Audible Originals. But every other audiobook in every publisher's catalog is available for sale from Libro.fm at the same price that Audible sells it at, but without DRM. And you tell them what your favorite bookstore is, and they will give them a commission every time you buy it, on the grounds that you've probably gone into that bookstore, perused the book in a paper edition, and then got back and bought the audio version from Libro. So they give them a share of the revenue. Wow. And so they're great, and it all works on your underwater MP3 player. But so, yeah, let's sorry.
But sticking with Libro for a minute. So
yeah.
So this is not a pirate site.
No,
this is an above board,
yeah,
legal thing, and they have made a contract with the book publishers to sell their Audible books.
Yep.
On the site.
Yeah, they're not their Audible books, but their Audio books.
Yeah,
yes.
Right.
Yeah, the ones that Audible does the financing for and produces, they only sell, to my knowledge, they only sell through Amazon. Although, you know, Overdrive, which supplies e-lending for public library systems, dropped their DRM from audiobooks like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so in theory, you can just check Audible titles out of the library using Overdrive and then just copy them off your phone if you want to listen to them on your MP3 player. Because that is, they do make them available as MP3s through Overdrive. Weirdly.
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting.
Whoa. Yeah.
Wow. That's cool. And so Libro FM also, I noticed, offers a comparable membership plan. It's like $15 a month, same as Audible.
Yeah, it's basically exactly like Audible, except you don't enrich an evil trillionaire.
Right. So, and in your own experience, is the selection of titles, you're saying, except for those few titles that maybe Amazon or Audible itself are recording, that you'd have basically the same wide selection,
the same catalog
to choose from.
Now there is a caveat there, which is that Audible did this super dirty thing where they bought books like 1 and 2 of series and recorded them and then just dropped it. They were like, oh, we didn't sell enough of that one, but they won't give the rights back to the author to resell, and nobody wants to do books 3, 4, 5, and 6 if they don't own 1 and 2. And so there are a lot of partially completed series that are only available through Audible, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. So that would be one thing you would suggest to authors is don't enter in a contract with Audible for a series, because you can get stuck really easily.
Well, and you know, the agents, the publishers, and the authors have all figured this out now. There's not as nearly as much of that as there used to be, but it is a historic artifact. And when they were growing, when they were in this like kind of massive growth spurt, they bought and locked up a ton of stuff that way.
Right.
Are there smartphone apps for Libro FM?
Yeah, there's a Libro.fm app, but it's also their MP3s, right? So like any MP3 player on your phone will play them. I have an audiobook player called Mort Play that I quite like.
How do you spell
Mort
it?
Player. MORTPLAYER.
Uh-huh.
And it's like yet another MP3 player.
Okay, I'm going to give this Libro FM a try. I see that they have Ronan Farrow's new book, Catch and Kill, available. And so, if they have that, I mean, they're going to have other major publishers' books.
Yeah.
Thanks for
and they have all your books, Corey?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. I've never done a deal with Audible. They refuse to carry my works. It's probably cost me enough money to buy a house, to be fair. Like, I really like living my principles is sometimes cheap, but not when it came to Audible. Like, my agent periodically will say, you could have had mid six figures at this point if you had agreed to let Amazon use your work to strengthen its monopoly. And I say no, because I am more interested in my daughter growing up in a pluralistic, fair world than I am in having that money.
Right.
That's cool, Corey.
I see they do carry my Inevitable, Libro, so that's great.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
That's great. So, Corey, let's talk about your upcoming book, the next
Attack
Little Brother
Surface
book.
Yeah. So Attack Surface is the first Little Brother book for kids. The Little Brother books are YA novels. They were my first YA books. They were New York Times bestsellers. Ed Snowden took one of them with him when he went on the run. You can see it in the documentary. And at the beginning and the end of those two books, there's a character called Masha, a young woman who, instead of working against mass surveillance, is actually part of the mass surveillance apparatus. When the incident that turns the protagonist of those books, Marcus, into a freedom fighter happens, it turns her into a snoop. And she ends up working for the DHS and then for private security contractors. And this is her story. It's a book for adults, not in the sense of having a lot of pornography or anything, but in the sense of just dealing with some like much more adult themes. And it's a book about how people who are fundamentally good talk themselves into doing the wrong thing.
Hmm.
And what it means when they change their minds. And it's a techno thriller, and it's full of like Little Brother and Homeland. It's full of a lot of like super cutting edge ideas. Like a major plot point revolves around this thing called the introspection engine that Ed Snowden and Bunny Wang built, which is a way to tell whether your phone is being spied on by adding a separate coprocessor, an isolated coprocessor that rides on the board so that you can see what is actually happening electrically across different points on the board. There's, you know, self-driving cars that get hijacked by non-state actors to be turned into like kill vehicles. There's facial recognition and computer vision dazzle where people are doing all kinds of things with adversarial examples. So it's super nerdy and techy. Like it really digs into the tech and leans into it and makes it really integral to the plot. Unlike a lot of techno thrillers where it's like, I need a computer to do a magic thing here. I will just assume that computers can do this magic thing. I start with like, what are the coolest things I know about the computers can do? And how do we make a plot around them? It's out October the 12th, and assuming epidemiology is what it is, then I will be on a US, Canadian, UK, and maybe German tour with it. So I might be coming to a city near you with it.
Remind me of the name again?
It's called Attack Surface.
What is an attack surface?
Oh, you know, in security, the attack surface is the part of the system that's vulnerable. So if you have a system that has a lot of code, or that has a lot of inputs and outputs, or that has a lot of integrated parts that are that were independently developed and all stick together, you talk about that as having a lot of attack surface. And what you want to do is reduce your attack surface so that you can whittle it down to something that you can exercise vigilance over, right? If your network only has a couple of ways that data gets in and out of it, then you can watch those points of ingress and outgress. You know, if your computer has an Ethernet port, but not a Wi-Fi router or not a Wi-Fi card, then it has less attack surface than if it had a wireless link. And then you add NFC, you add Bluetooth. Well, now it's got a lot of attack surface because all of those things have their own embedded controllers with their own embedded logic. And they're all horribly, vulnerable to attack. I don't know if you remember bad USB when someone's figured out how to write malware for the standard USB controller, which is like a system on a chip with its own operating system that is not your computer, right? It's like it's running its own code and no one ever patches. It's almost impossible to patch. And you can infect that and then it can infect your computer and everything you put in or out of your computer also gets infected that way. It's you know,
wow.
Like, so that's a lot of attack surface. Our computers have a lot of attack surface.
What's one tip that you have, Corey, for people to reduce their attack surface?
I would say if there's like one thing you were going to do, it would be to use to switch your browser to Brave. Brave is really tight. They've really whittled down Chrome. It's a Chrome derivative, but it's very, very privacy oriented. And they've just like gone at it with a pair of digital pliers and ripped everything out that isn't essential to browsing, and then replaced it with a bunch of super privacy respecting stuff that does ad block, but also like tracker block. I'm really fond of it. The team behind it, especially Yan, who's their security head of security, used to work with me at EFF, and she is so smart and so honorable. I mean, it doesn't really scale to say like I trust this because I know the person who made it. Like, it would be nice if we could have ways to trust things like, you know, the FTC would have shut them down if it wasn't trustworthy. That would be a really great alternative to, I happen to personally know these people. But, you know, like, I do happen to personally know these people, and I think they're on the side of justice.
That's cool.
And is, in general, browsers a particularly problematic part of our life?
Yeah, it's ghastly. And, you know, back to Brave. So the World Wide Web Consortium, which standardizes browsers, about 4 years ago, we had a huge fight with them through the Electronic Frontier Foundation because they were putting in DRM for streaming video. And the way that the law works, the same law that protects Audible, is it makes it potentially a felony for a security researcher to audit that code and reveal that it has a defect that might allow an attacker to gain access to your browser and attack everything you control with it. You know, whether it's like the embedded controller for your pacemaker or the thing that lets you get at your Bitcoin or your bank account or the camera and the mic in your computer or whatever. And we told them that they shouldn't do it because of this risk. And the World Wide Web Consortium said, no, it's fine. The people who want to make DRM don't want to be able to shut down security researchers. They just don't want piracy. And we said, great, we should make them promise that as a condition of participating in the standards body, that they will not ever use this standard that they're developing to attack security researchers, that they won't get a new legal right from this over whether or not people can make truthful disclosures about how defective their products are. And Brave came in with us on this. They voted in favor of it, but all the major browser vendors voted against it. In the end, only 58% of the membership supported it. Normally, the W3C only publishes things that they have consensus on. They have never had a standard with this much contention. And the management of the W3C overruled all of the objections and published the standards. So it's in browsers now. One of the reasons you're not seeing new open source browsers emerge is you can't get a license for this technology if you're open source. And so nobody can make a new browser that can play back video using the supposedly open standard unless they agree to make their browser proprietary.
Is that why when I use the Brave browser, one of the reasons that I don't use it as much as I would like to, is when I play YouTube videos, it doesn't let me skip the ads after 5 seconds. It like makes me watch the whole ad.
Oh, that's weird. I don't know why that is. That sounds unrelated. Okay. And it's hard to know. I mean, I honestly don't know.
So in a brief moment, why do you have a YouTube subscription? Most people are watching for free. What do you get from the subscription?
I'm trying to remember all the reasons I did it, because I did it so long ago that now it just happens on autopilot. But I think the big one was at the time, and I don't know if this is still true, you couldn't background a YouTube video on a phone. So it had to be foregrounded. And so like I would want to do things like put on a YouTube video that was like an hour-long lecture by Yochai Benkler, who's this great, you know, professor. And I don't want to watch it. It's just him standing at a podium. I just want to listen to it while I'm like driving and I have the map up. But it wouldn't let you switch the map to the foreground. It would make you put the video in the foreground, which first of all is super distracting. But second of all, then you wouldn't have your map anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
So the paid version allowed you to do that.
Yeah, that's right. I think that was my big the thing that really convinced me to do it.
Okay.
So we are about to sign off because we have another recording to do. But Corey, what's the best place for people to like find out what you're doing, what you're writing about, what you're thinking about?
So I have a new media empire of my own, pretty low-key media empire. It's a blog, a Twitter feed, a newsletter, and a Mastodon feed, and it's called Pluralistic. If you go to twitter.com/doctorow, the pinned tweet every day is the day's threads. I do threads of all the interesting links that I find, like a blog post. Mm-hmm. If you go to pluralistic.net, they're available as blog posts. And then from pluralistic.net, you can see there's a link at the top to sign up for the newsletter version, which is called the Pluralist. Ha ha. And that goes out every day as well. They're all, with the exception of Twitter, they're all ad-free. Twitter, I think, puts ads in. There's no tracking. There's no data collection of any kind. Ken Snyder, both Mark, you're my mutual systems administrator, did a lot of work with the WordPress templates to rip out all possible sources of tracking and data collection. So like we have my GDPR compliance statement is I haven't collected any of your data ever, period, and never will, which makes for a really clean little GDPR statement. And then my Mastodon is at pluralistic at mamot.fr. At pluralistic at mamot.fr. And that's that Mastodon instance, it's run by Quadrature de Net, who are like the French equivalent of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They're good old internet freedom fighters. So I really like their Mastodon instance.
Cool.
And and your newsletter and your blogs, are they things that you're writing or things that you're kind of pointing to?
It's a real old fashioned blog. It's like, here are all the things that I saw on the internet that are interesting. Ooh. And here are all the things that I care about. Yeah. And here are the things that are happening in my life. And it's just like, you know, as David Weinberger says, everything is miscellaneous. They're in the order I find them, and I round them up every day and I blast them out. So it's one big whack.
Okay.
Very cool. Well, Corey, thank you so much. This has been a blast talking
to you. Oh, yeah. My pleasure.
That's great.
Yes, really great to have you.
Yeah, thanks. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys again when we're all allowed to meet in person. Okay. Keep washing your hands.
Hey, everybody. It's Mark from the Cool Tools Podcast. I want to thank you for being a listener to Cool Tools. And I also would like to let you know about our Patreon page. If you would like to support the Cool Tools show, as well as our video channel, the website, and all the newsletters that we do, you can go to patreon.com/cooltools. That's just one word, cool tools, and pledge any amount you want. You could even pledge $1 a month. Every little bit helps. We have editors, we pay for transcribing costs, we pay our reviewers. Every bit of money that you contribute goes towards supporting the show. I'd like to give a shout out to our supporters of the Cool Tools podcast. This week, I'd like to thank the following Patreon supporters: Bill Schuler, Bob Kay, Brian Pelly, Carl D. Patterson, Chad Cosby, Chris Wieland, Chris Weirstook, Craig Tooker, Dan O'Brien, Dean Putney, Danelle Cunningham, Evan Barker, Graham Medlin, Hans Riesbeck, Helen Hegedus, Jerry Kearns, Jim Lesko, Jim Spofford, John Pollock, John Burdenbau, Keith O., Ken Altman, Les Howard, Lauren Bast, Mock Nerd, Malton Make, Mark Goebel, Matt Gromes, Michael Douglas, Michael Jones, and Michael Pecorini. Thanks to all of you for supporting the Cool Tools Show. We really appreciate it.